Previously on Beta.
I want to ask you a bunch of questions. I want to have them answered immediately.
Georgina had problems too. Her appetizer was supposed to be an artichoke slider.
Yeah, but it was actually just a kitten on a hamburger bun.
If taking IT courses gives you daydreams of solving chemical equations, writing literary novels, or some different career path other than instruction, stop taking IT courses immediately and consult your academic advisor.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, writer and editor Lori Wolliver reflects on working and co-writing with the late Anthony Bourdain.
He had a spasm of grief, loneliness, of, you know, extreme heartbreak, disappointment, and that led him to make a really terrible decision to end his own life.
Also, the great Canadian author Alex Olin maps out her incredible short story collection, We Want What We Want.
Some of the cultural discourse around motherhood can be quite binary, like either people are perfect and angelic mothers or they are terrible and demonized. And I'm interested in all the kind of flawed and messy middle space between those two.
But first, Shea Serrano joins us. He's a staff writer at The Ringer and a New York Times bestselling author. He's also the host of the No Skips Music Podcast. That's appropriate because Shea's latest book is called Hip Hop and Other Things. It's the third and final book in Shea's and Other Things series. You alphas with elephant memories may remember that Shea joined us to talk about his second book in the series, Movies and Other Things. We always have a blast when Shea stops by. In fact, one of our biggest regrets is that we never had him on to talk about the first book in the trilogy, Basketball and Other Things. But hey, we weren't on the air yet. And there's no use crying over missed opportunities. To quote Meatloaf, now don't be sad, because 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Hip Hop and Other Things again features the fantastic illustrations of Arturo Torres. And it wouldn't be a Shea Serrano book without the surreal, Serrano-esque, thought experimentish questions that Shea poses and answers. Shea joined us from his Texas home to chat about some of his favorite stories from the world of hip hop and to tell us why he saved this book for last.
I've been really excited about this book in particular because when we started this series out, I'm talking about me and Arturo Torres, the illustrator. He's based out of Dallas, Texas. When we started it ahead of time, we said, hey, what's the one we want to end on? We knew we were going to do an And Other Things series. We said, well, we want to do 3 of them. Let's pick 3 things. Movie, we love movies, we love basketball, we love rap. Which of those do we want to be like the anchor? The big like finale, you know, you got to finish strong. You don't want a Godfather 3 the situation. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. No, you don't want that.
You want a John Wick 3 the situation, like a big flurry.
Absolutely.
The third one. And so we say, okay, well, this is like, we really, really care a great, great deal about rap. So let's end on that one. So we made that decision 6 years ago in 2015 when we started working on all these. So I've been really excited about this one. That's why it's number one for me, just because we knew we were going to land here.
You say in the dedication of this new book that rap is best listened to in the car. So I have to ask, what was the best car or stereo or song or moment that makes you think that?
This is going to be such a like goofy, I don't even know, comparison, but here's the answer. I was just going to say the answer, and then you can figure out all the rest of the pieces.
Thank you.
But when I was 17, I got my first car, a car I was proud of. It was a little tiny Hyundai. It was like $2,000. My dad bought it for me. We went to one of those little like off the side of the road dealerships where they're just like, it's kind of sketchy, but not really. And I found a little red car, a little red Hyundai. And I was like, Dad, can I get this one? And it was within the price range, $2,000. So I got it, and it had a CD player in it. And I played in there the album Harlem World by Mace.
One thing about Harlem World, we all got dough. 98 Tahoe, Tommy and the Roscoe. Case I'm ever chased by Donnie Brasco.
Why you over there looking at me? Why my girl standing here?
Come on.
I just felt like I was the king of the world while I was listening to that album in that car, riding around on my own for the first time. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. In 1997, Missy Elliott released her album Supa Dupa Fly. But perhaps more importantly, she released the video for her song The Rain. This video basically created a template for rap videos of the era. As you point out, Missy's famous air-blown outfit that she wears was more than a fashion statement. What's the story behind that?
Okay, so the quickest version of this story here is prior to becoming the mega superstar that Missy was, she preferred to stay in the shadows, to be in the background. She wanted to be like a songwriter, producer, like that, work in that world. So that's what she was doing at the beginning of her career. And she wrote a song for Raven Simone, the child actor slash rapper slash just all around entertainer. The song called That's What Little Girls Are Made Of. And she, and I say she, I'm talking about Missy, had a small feature in the song. She the little raven come true, let her woke up, so boom, 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 give her room, so she juggle, man, you want me get down the fucking rhythm, kapoy, 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 that's what I give them, I take them to the... But then when they shot the video for it, they replaced Missy in there. They told her after the fact, after they'd already recorded it, hey, we had, there's like a thinner woman with lighter skin, and she was doing Missy's parts, and they told her that she just didn't have the right look to be in the video. And this is, of course, a thing that like had to, broke Missy's heart. She talked about it with the Guardian in 2001. I think she said something like, they said I could sing, I could write, but that I looked wrong. And that was like the lowest thing you could say. So that happens in 1993, right? So she's in the background for all of this stuff. And then she like parlays her growing reputation into this really interesting deal with Elektra Records, where they were gonna give her her own imprint, but they said in exchange, you have to give us one album, like one Missy album. This is Sylvia Rhone, the genius record executive. And Missy's like, okay, cool. She makes the album, and the song, the first single for it, the first video for it is for the song The Rain.
Me, I'm super fly, super duper fly, super duper fly. Me, I'm super fly, super duper fly, super duper fly.
Which is probably like the iconic Missy Elliott song. And it starts out with her, like the first image you see of her, and then like the everlasting Missy Elliott image is her in the inflated black leather suit. It's like, this is Hype Williams directing it, so he's using the fisheye lens. And so there she is, like, she's exaggerating all of the things that they said were wrong about her in the beginning. You know, her size, her color, her shape, her everything. And she's like, no, this is like, here's a bigger version of all of it, all while she is saying over and over again how like cool she is. I'm super duper fly, super duper fly, super. She says it 10 times in a row, like it's not an accident. And from that moment forward, everybody knew like, oh, this is a special artist that we're watching here. It's a really a great moment in rap by itself, but then you learn that part of it and you're like, oh, this meant even more than you knew at the time. Nobody knew this in 1997. There wasn't the internet to like find out all this information. I didn't know about it until like a couple of years ago.
Good for her. That's really great that she did that, yeah. One of the most intriguing careers of any hip-hop artist in history has to be Lauryn Hill's. After back-to-back multi-platinum albums, she essentially retired from music. What do you think Lauryn Hill's legacy is to hip-hop and to music in general?
She's the one responsible for like blurring what the lines were between R&B and hip-hop. She had this really great... quote, I know this sounds crazy, but sometimes I treat rapping like singing, and other times I treat singing like rapping. But still, it's all done within the context of hip-hop. And so you hear her say that, and you're like, oh, okay, this is exactly right, because this is an answer that when you hear it, it's both absolute, but also completely open to interpretation. And that's where Lauryn Hill fits in that conversation. You have to have somebody like that. Lauryn is only human. Don't think I haven't been through the same predicament. Let it women in Philly pen. It's silly when girls sell their souls because it's sin. Look at where you be in. Hair weaves like Europeans. Fake nails done by Koreans. Come again.
Do you have a favorite Lauryn Hill song?
Oh, I have like 10 favorite Lauryn Hill songs.
Yeah, that's what I figured. It's tough to narrow it down to one.
if we're gonna pick one, the very first one that I think of, this is probably not the right answer, but the very first one that I think of is the song To Zion, which is what she was singing about her unborn child. People were telling her after she got pregnant, this is the beginning of her career, hey, you should get an abortion, this is going to ruin your career. That's all. She's singing a song to her unborn child.
Everybody told me to be smart. Look at your career, they said. Lauryn, baby, use your head. But instead, I chose to use my heart. Now the joy of my world is in Zion.
Way that she sings that on the hook, when you hear it, just knowing what it was and what it meant, it's so extremely powerful. As I'm talking, I'm realizing right now that the stuff that I'm always drawn to is when you tell a person, hey, don't do that thing, and then they're like, no, you know what, I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna do it better than you ever thought it could be done. That's what I like right now.
And you'll be pleased to know, Shay, I just heard from our judges, and that is indeed the correct answer. That is the right answer. Well done.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. In 1994, Nasir Jones, better known as Nas, forever changed the rap landscape when he released his debut album, Illmatic. The album is rap royalty and has been studied and written about, perhaps most famously, in Michael Eric Dyson's book, Born to Use Mics. Why is Illmatic so influential?
Number one, it's just Nas is maybe the greatest writer in rap ever, and this is when he did the best writing of his career. So you have that going on. Plus also, this was 1994, which is really when rap is taking off and becoming this gigantic juggernaut. This is right around when Tupac is about to start popping up, and Biggie, and you know, Snoop had just come out in 93, Dr. Dre in 92, Wu-Tang Clan in 93 as well. Like, all of these great, great voices are coming out. Jay-Z is about to start bubbling out. Nas shows up and he puts this album out, and it is at once an album that plants a flag in a moment in time and says, this is what rap sounds like in New York in 1994 at its highest level. But then also, it like peaked forward as well. This is what hopefully rap will sound like for the rest of time. Or, you know, if you go 100 years in the future, this is still going to sound like it's ahead of that. It was doing so many different things. It doesn't hurt that Nas is exceptionally cool. I'm like Sly Stone and Cobra, packing like a Rasa in the weed spot. Vocals are squeezed, Glocks and CZs drop, though they need not to sneak. My poetry's deep, I never fell. Nas's rap should be locked in a cell. It ain't hard to tell. It certainly doesn't hurt that he's like a handsome, insightful person. It was like all of the things you wanted to see in a rapper and in a rap album all at once. And it came from a kid. He's in his early 20s when he does this, so seemingly out of nowhere. And he just like presents you with this brilliant piece of art. And everybody freaked out about it. And it didn't matter how much you freaked out about it or heard about it beforehand. When you got the chance to listen to it, it always was better than you thought it was going to be. You can listen to it now and it's still, we've been talking about it for a few minutes. If you play it right now, you're going to be like, oh, he didn't do near a good enough job. It just outpaces everything.
Mm-hmm. And it still does, as you mentioned. I was going to ask you that. It still sounds like it's way ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive. Two of the best albums of the last decade of any genre are Kendrick Lamar's Good Kid, Mad City and Kanye's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. You set out to see which of these top two was not two. What was your verdict?
Yeah, out of those two albums, which of those is the best? And again, it's the same thing. You start out with a question and then you just go, okay, like, how do we pick this apart? Because it's not any fun if I'm just like, hey, what's your favorite XTC song? And then you just tell me the song. Like, that's not fun.
No.
I want you to walk me through, how did you get there? Because I have found that people are much more receptive to a result, to an answer of a question, if they know how you arrived at that thing. Mm-hmm. So if I just go, hey, Kendrick's Good Kid, Mad City is better than Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, they're going to be like, well, you can go to H-E double hockey sticks. I don't believe you.
Yeah.
I don't believe you. But if I walk you through how we get there, then you're, even if you don't agree with it, you're going to be like, oh, okay, well, I see how we landed here. Same way as if we flip it. If I say, hey, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is better than Good Kid, Mad City, and you don't agree, but I can show you how we arrived there, well, then it makes for a much more interesting conversation or reading experience.
Yeah, very well said. So this is the final book in the And Other Things series, but I just want to pose a thought experiment to you, since you're very fond of thought experiments, as am I. If someone were to offer you $2 million, I don't know, $3 million, whatever dollars to write a fourth installment in the And Other Things series, what would it be about?
It would be about what idiot thought it'd be a good idea to give me $3 million to rent it. It would be called that, $3 million and other things. No, you know what it would be? I think the natural thing to do here would be television and other things.
Yeah.
The TV shows are just, they're smaller versions of movies, but they're also like bigger versions of movies. You hear that so much now when you're like, whatever the new prestige TV show is, and they're like, oh, it's not 10 episodes of 30 minutes. It's like a 5-hour movie. So television and other things would probably be the one that made the most sense. Because if you can connect, it's very easy to draw a line from like basketball to hip hop. We can draw that same line from movies to television, especially now when it's just like the internet has blown up everything. And all of a sudden the biggest movie stars in the world are doing, Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain just did a TV series together that barely anybody talked about. And it's like, well, it's Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain. Like, this should be the biggest thing in the world. But it's, like, atomized.
Yeah, and it's based on an Ingmar Bergman film, right? Scenes from a Marriage.
Exactly.
Yeah, what
That's
more
exactly
do you want?
What it is.
Exactly. So what is next for you?
I don't know. All that I know is I got to figure it out in the next couple of months. That way, 2 years from now, you and I are having a new version of this conversation again. This has become my favorite tradition.
Yeah.
When I call you up and when we talk about stuff. That's great.
Yeah. And then maybe within those 2 years, maybe I'll start a GoFundMe page and raise the money to get you to write the television and other things. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. Shea Serrano, thank you for joining us once again. We always enjoy talking to you, and we'll talk to you again 2 years from now about your next book. I can hardly wait. Me neither. Thank you so much, Shea. This was great.
All right, homie.
Shea Serrano is the author of Hip Hop and Other Things. We'll keep you posted if and when we're able to make television and other things happen. Fingers crossed. You can find out more about Shea, hip-hop, and loads of other things at wpr.org/Beatty.
They were not willing to compromise and try and shoehorn Tony into what a network probably would have wanted from him, which is barbecue rodeo in a parking lot.
Lori Wolever, Anthony Bourdain's longtime assistant and co-author, joins us in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Anthony Bourdain took his own life in June 2018. More than 3 years later, he is still missed. His memoir, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, marked a turning point in his life and had a big impact on those who read it. Then Tony invented a new way of telling stories about food and travel for television. Writer and editor Lori Wolever spent nearly a decade helping Tony and co-authoring his books. She has published a book called Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography, and it truly is the definitive book about Bourdain. Lori interviewed almost 100 of Tony's closest friends, family, and co-workers who were part of the Bourdainverse. She joins us now to talk about the legacy he left, the many hats he wore, and how the two of them became co-workers and friends.
I actually first met Tony in 2002. He hired me to help out recipe editing and testing for Anthony Bourdain's Layal cookbook, which was his first cookbook, and it was something that came up after he published Kitchen Confidential. So that first meeting, I had already read Kitchen Confidential, like everyone else in New York and in the country. So I had a specific idea of what I thought Tony would be like, you know, brash and funny and outspoken and very, you know, a big personality. And the person that I met that day was actually much more reserved and quiet, kind of shy and almost socially awkward. We had a pretty quick meeting with his other chef and the owner of the restaurant. And it was just, it was not what at all what I expected, but he was lovely. He was much more kind of ground level than I expected. And that really was the case throughout my time knowing and working with him.
Hmm. Tony published Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly in 2000, and it became a New York Times bestseller. Why was this book so successful?
I think there are a number of reasons. I think first and foremost, Tony had such a distinctive and really charismatic and engaging writing voice. You know, it was funny, it was sharp, it brought in a lot of cultural and historical references. It was deeply personal. In as much as he skewered other people, he was also very willing to skewer himself and lay bare his own faults and bad decisions, often to hilarious effect.
I took it in my hand, tilted the shell back into my mouth as instructed by the now beaming Monsieur Saint-Jure, and with one bite and a slurp, wolfed it down. It tasted of seawater, of brine and flesh, and somehow of the future. Everything was different now, everything. I'd not only survived, I'd enjoyed. This, I knew, was the magic I had until now been only dimly and spitefully aware of. I was hooked.
So there was that. And then also, I think the subject matter came at just the right time. This was a time in food writing and food media where things were very buttoned up. And all of the magazine articles and everything really focused on high-end luxury and really just the surface of things. And Tony was the first in his era to really pull back the layers and say, this is what really goes on. And this is the truth about the entire business, not just what you see on the plate or what you see at the front door, but really the whole thing. And people love to be told the truth and to really know the secrets of what goes on behind the facade.
Mm, very well said. Tony told his editor, Karen Rinaldi, that if he ever did TV, that would be a big sellout. So how did he end up doing television?
Well, I think he saw television as part of this grab at the brass ring, and this gets addressed in the book. You know, he understood that if he wanted to keep being successful, if he wanted to figure out a way to make money and make a living and not have to go back into the kitchen, that he would have to expand his profile beyond making books. It's very satisfying to write a book, but I'll tell you, it is not a path to financial success unless you are a Stephen King or a James Patterson or, you know, one of a handful of writers. But I think he understood that if he wanted to keep this thing going, he was going to have to do television.
Mm-hmm. Anderson Cooper told you that, quote, finding your voice as a writer is one thing, making that into television is a completely other thing, unquote. How did Tony make that transition?
Well, I think he had the right partners. He started out and all the way through his career, he worked with Lydia Tenaglia and Chris Collins, who were his partners at 0.0 Production. And they were just, when they first started out, they were just two people making sort of freelance television, and they built their work with Tony into a full company. So they recognized right away that Tony had such a singular voice, and they were really champions of him getting to keep that voice and getting to refine it for television. You know, they were not willing to compromise and try and shoehorn Tony into, what a network probably would have wanted from him, which is barbecue rodeo in a parking lot. You know, they really wanted to make sure that his voice, which was the thing that broke him out into the world, that was maintained as much as possible.
First thing you encounter when you visit Tsukiji is big. It's really big. It's really spread out. And the choreography has to be seen to be believed. There's a system here. Everybody seems to know the moves except me.
And then, you know, he had to fight on his own, too. There's a section in the book where different people talk about his very strongly worded, hilarious, and lacerating emails that he would write to editors, producers, directors, to network executives. I mean, he felt so strongly about the purity of his vision that he was willing to burn it all down.
Right. He was very much a perfectionist. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, with the understanding that nothing is ever truly perfect, as a writer, I think he always knew that there was a little bit more that he could have done. And I think this is a very common thing. David Simon talks about it in the book, that even if you know that you've done your best, you always know that there was a little more. There was something you didn't quite achieve on the page, no matter how well received it is.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of David Simon, that was something I didn't know until I read your book and read the quotes from David Simon, that Tony actually wrote scripts or partial scripts or scenes or helped with scenes about that take place in the restaurant for Tremé, right?
That's right. He was so thrilled. I remember when he got the news that he was going to be a staff writer for Tremé, and he said, this is an absolute high water mark for my career. This is, I cannot think of a better thing for me to do than to be writing on a David Simon series. He was so thrilled. And so they brought him in for at least two, if not three seasons to write the restaurant storyline. And he was so good at it.
If we're going to be true to what we believe.
Excuse me. This is how the Creole fairy folk back home cure their 3-day stubble.
I told you. Sazerac. They gotta be kidding. Nobody throws a Sazerac.
David and Eric Overmeyer and Lolis Eli all talk about being in the writer's room with Tony and, you know, how quick he was to turn scenes around. And he brought all of that knowledge from being a cook and a chef for almost 30 years into those scenes and just really lent an air of authenticity to all of the restaurant stuff that went on Tremé.
Mm. In 2013, Tony launched Parts Unknown on CNN, and this really seemed to be the ultimate TV show for Tony. It really showed off his talents. What was he doing differently on Parts Unknown that made it work so well?
Well, I think there was an increased seriousness in some ways. Now, of course, there was still plenty of humor. There were still plenty of episodes where it wasn't that serious. You know, they went to Lyon, France, really just to dig into the deep, beautiful food culture there. And there was very little about politics or any of that. But there were plenty of shows where they were able to use the resources of CNN, the security, the worldwide renown of a news organization like CNN. They were able to use those things to get deeper than they might have with the other cable networks that he was involved in the past. So he was able to tell the kinds of stories that he really wanted to tell.
Eating something out of a bowl that I'm not exactly sure what it is. Scooters going by. So delicious. I feel like an animal. Where have you been all my life? Fellow travelers, this is what you want. This is what you need. This is the path to true happiness and wisdom.
It made, I think, more people willing to talk and willing to open up, knowing that this wasn't a cable travel show, that this was some pastiche of hard news and storytelling and documentary filmmaking. Tony wanted for years to go to the Congo, and they just couldn't, when he was with travel, they just couldn't quite get the right insurance and the right security and the right sense that they could go and successfully tell a story and get out. And so it was only with CNN that he was able to finally realize that dream of it. And things got dicey at some points.
The Congo is a place I've dreamed of visiting since before I ever thought I'd get the chance to travel the world. Actually being here, I'm not so sure.
You know, so I think CNN really just gave him the confidence and the structure to go deeper.
When was the last time you saw Anthony Bourdain?
The last time I saw him in person was in New York in about mid-May of 2018. It was a few weeks before he left to go to Alsace, which is where he died. We met in the voiceover studio that he used to do television. It was a Friday morning, probably mid-May, and he was ecstatic. He was, at that point, just about to leave for Florence, where they shot an episode of Parts Unknown that never ended up making it into an episode because it was just too raw and painful. But they spent a lot of time in the Uffizi Gallery examining and discussing art, and it would have been an amazing episode.
Yeah, and just a few weeks later, in early June 2018, Tony hanged himself in his hotel room in France. Why do you think he took his life?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? As I said earlier in the conversation, he was someone who lived life always, you know, at 11 or at 1,000%, right? So one thing that had really taken more and more of his time and energy was a romantic relationship that he was in for the last 2 years of his life. And this gets quite a bit of time in the book, the observations of the people around him, that it had become an obsession and something that he was pouring all of his energy into a lot of times at the expense of everything else in his life. So there was some trouble in his relationship in that last week before he died. So I think the short answer is he had a spasm of grief, loneliness, of, you know, extreme heartbreak, disappointment, and that led him to make a really terrible decision to end his own life.
What did you think of Morgan Neville's documentary about Tony, Roadrunner?
I thought it was brilliant. I will disclose that I was a consulting producer on the film, so I'm not an impartial party to this, but I am not myself a filmmaker, and I really was really pleased with the work that the filmmakers did, especially considering that they never got a chance to meet Tony in person. There was such an extraordinarily treasure trove of footage from all of his television shows and this beautiful documentary footage that was shot about 20 years ago or more that never got made into a film. But I really loved the way that they were able to use that and kind of weave that into modern day interviews. I know there was some controversy around a small bit of AI that was used in the film to recreate Tony's voice. And I bring it up only because I think it was such a, it did such a disservice to the film that became the dominant narrative during the opening theatrical release weekend. And I just felt that it was really unfortunate and really unfair to the filmmakers that, our internet tendency to pile on without all the facts really sort of overshadowed what was, to me, a brilliant and beautiful film. And for 45 seconds worth of AI in a 2-hour film that was full of Tony's actual voice, I just thought people were really missing the story if they were clutching their pearls over a bit of technology.
Mm-hmm. And because in all fairness, they were Tony's words, the outrage was that he never recorded them. What do you think Tony Bourdain's legacy is?
Oh, I think it's a huge legacy. You know, I think that he certainly made the restaurant industry very, very attractive to a lot of people who might have otherwise gone into different careers. I'm sure he's responsible for any number of very, well-educated, well-rounded people kind of tossing it all aside to go be a line cook or a chef or a maitre d', for good and bad. I mean, I think it probably really energized the industry at a time when it was starting to feel that it needed a shot in the arm. I think he's also probably encouraged a lot of people to look at whatever it is in their lives, whatever their careers are, whatever their story is, and see something worth telling and see that if you just tell the truth in an engaging way, that could be something that somebody else wants to read. And then, of course, I think he has encouraged people to travel in a different way, to be very, a little bit more open, a little bit more mindful, a little bit more interested in not just the major tourist attractions of a place, but to spend time looking at, you know, what do regular people who live here, what do they eat? What's the street food? What's the cafe? And what are the conditions of people's lives, I think, in a way that wasn't really part of the conversation 20 or 25 years ago. Now people are wondering, are people making enough money? Do the people who live here get enough to eat? You know, how does the government play into how people are living and what they're eating? So I think he had an enormous impact on the culture.
Lori Wolliver, thank you very much for joining us today and for the great conversation. Congratulations on Bourdain, the definitive oral biography, and also on your podcast, Carb Face.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Lori Wolliver is the author of Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. You can find out more about Lori and Tony Bourdain at wpr.org/beta.
You know, one of the great things about being a writer is that in my work, I can experience all kinds of other lives.
Alex Olin joins us to talk about her short story collection, We Want What We Want. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. So I'm exploring the internet, perusing book reviews like I always do to make sure you alphas get the very best. That's when I stumbled across a review of a new short story collection by Alex Olin. One of the stories is about a cult, and it turns out the title of Alex's book is a quote from my favorite philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer. Arthur is so pessimistic, he makes me look like a cockeyed optimist. I guess that's what I like about art. Then, I discovered that Alex is a fellow Canadian, and she is the director of the University of British Columbia School of Creative Writing. I know what you're thinking. That's the very same writing program that Doug studied at. Correct! I receive a copy of We Want What We Want, and that title is totally appropriate. Alex's stories are amazing, and they are exactly what I want. This is one of the best short story collections I've ever read. She joins us now to talk about the art of the short story and what it was about this phrase, we want what we want, that made her decide to use it as the title of her collection.
In all of these stories, people want things and can't necessarily control the effects or consequences of those desires, or at least they come up against them. And sometimes we do want things that can lead us into the realm of the ridiculous or into the realm of making mistakes. But it's also how we learn about ourselves. We learn about what's lacking in our lives by figuring out what we want that we don't currently have. So that's the string that ties all of these stories together, this question of what are we looking for, what are we searching for, and what happens when we try to find it.
Yeah, and that's why there's this great sense of continuity throughout the book. To me, it kind of made me think that it was the literary equivalent of a concept album because of this thread that you have running through this connective tissue. And that's another thing that makes it such a strong and cohesive collection. Is this desire to remake one's life, is that something that resonates with you?
Well, first of all, I just want to say how much I love that you use the phrase concept album, because I think that that's a really great analogy for short story collections as a whole. I think that the experience of reading short stories all together is like an album in that each story is a bit different, but hopefully they do come from or result in a unified aesthetic experience.
Oh, thank you.
I would say that a lot of the characters in this book are coming up against a point in their lives. Sometimes it's middle age, sometimes it's coming to the end of an experience, either a relationship or a job or just a period in their lives. And they're looking back on it and trying to figure out how they got there and what it means. And I think that is something that resonates with me personally. I've moved around a lot. I've lived in a lot of different places in the US and Canada. And I am still connected to some people from different chapters of my life and not connected to others. And I think a lot about that and what it means and how our lives are made up of some experience that are continuous and others that are discontinuous. And the things that change and the things that stay the same, I'm always grappling with that and trying to figure out what I can take with me going forward from those experiences.
Mm-hmm. But there isn't a different kind of life that you'd rather be living. Like you're happy with what you're doing now, right? Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. But, you know, one of the great things about being a writer is that in my work, I can experience all kinds of other lives that I'm not living myself. So I kind of get to have the best of both worlds. I can live my life that I'm very happy with, but also explore alternative experiences through the lives of my characters. And I'm pretty sedate and well-behaved in my day-to-day life. And so it's great for me to have the outlet of putting the mistakes or the wayward desires into the characters in my books rather than having to experience those consequences myself.
Very well said. I was really struck by the EFP, the energy, flow, and pace of your writing. You don't waste any words, and your opening sentences grabbed my attention right away. How hard do you have to work to accomplish this, to use the fewest number of words and to create these really gripping openings?
Well, thank you for that. I love a strong opening. I love to plunge the reader right into the moment of the story. And I think that's one of the strengths of the short story as a form, is that it's very compressed. It's very brief. You have to get the reader right into the lives of your characters and explain what's happening. And then almost before you know it, it's over. So for me, that's very pleasurable, is like whittling down a longer piece of writing to focus only on the strongest and most powerful aspects of a person's life.
Mm-hmm. Most short story collections focus on short narratives, and you take that even further by focusing on small human granular moments. You just allow the reader in to experience this character moment, and that's it. What is your approach to story structure?
I'm really interested in story structure. I'm really interested in stories and their relationship to time. As you say, I do love to go really deep into some particular granular moment in time, but then I also really am drawn to leaps in time, where a story might then follow the person like 5 or 10 years later and see what the impacts have been of that. And I think that's something that fiction is really well situated to explore, the interior of people's lives and then the kind of echoing ripple effects that ensue, you know, from someone's childhood to adulthood or several years later. So I often think about stories as having a physical shape or structure, a story in the shape of a triangle or in the shape of a prism. And then I'll try to write something that, at least in my mind, reflects that structure, and hope it brings me to a kind of more inventive way of putting scenes together.
Mm-hmm. I've read that when you read stories that you admire, you find mapping their forms visually to be very helpful.
I do. I'm someone who, I really love visual art, and I find it a real inspiration for writing. And when I read, I have an almost synesthetic experience where I see the story in a visual way, and I'll often draw a map or a diagram of it. So to me, a certain story might, it might look like a pendulum swing in my mind, and that's how I see the journey of the characters across the page. Or a story might look like an aqueduct, with some things kind of happening above and then other things happening closer to the water below. And for me, rather than thinking about the kind of conventional beginning, middle, or end, or a kind of, oh, there's a beginning and then a climax and then a denouement, that many people learn that kind of structure in high school, for me, thinking about these alternative maps or diagrams of stories is really inspiring. And it's also feels to me more true to the complicated, fragmented nature of our lives today. So I use those maps, and then I try to think, well, what map would make sense for my characters in this story, in this situation? What can I draw for them that would make sense?
Mm-hmm. So do you ever map your own stories?
I do sometimes. Yeah, absolutely. And I often think of, where can I find the movement or the shape in my story? Where is there a swerve? I like to think of a story as having a sinuous kind of movement, like a snake slithering along the ground, in the sense that I don't want it to be a straightforward experience that's super linear from point A to point B. I hope that by finding some kind of unexpected angles or triangulations or curves, then I can surprise and delight the reader in the same way that I feel surprise and delight in a feeling of discovery or the unexpected myself when I'm writing these stories.
Which is why, I guess, the reason that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't figure out your stories in advance. Like, you don't write an outline. You just kind of go where the story and the characters take you. Is that right?
That's right. I'm not an outliner, and I'm always super envious of writers who are good outliners. I met someone recently who had an Excel spreadsheet for her novel where she had it all laid out with the character journeys and the timeline, and I was fascinated by that, in part because it's so different from my own process. I love the part of writing that is mysterious and alchemical, where I myself don't know what is going to happen next. It's a real process of discovery and exploration, investigation, almost like an archaeology of character, like discovering who these people are and what would make sense for them and how they might react. Putting a normal character in an extraordinary situation, like my story, The Brooks Brother Guru, where a woman finds herself in the context of this strange cult environment. My mother loved music, she says, especially the Beatles. George was her favorite. She said the mark of a sensitive person was to pick George. What she says next makes her realize she's drunk. I wish I knew things like you do. The guru smiles again, and now he seems not fussy, but gentle and kind. You could learn them if you joined us here. The idea that she would stay here with these khaki-clad scholar men, Wendy to their lost boys, Snow White to their dwarfs, is so absurd that she can't even think of how to answer. And yet, she doesn't say no. To learn about art and music and literature and philosophy, wouldn't it be a good life? And also, it's like a drug to be wanted. For me, what I especially enjoy about that is the kind of explosive potential of what could happen in that situation where I myself don't know in advance what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. The theme of addiction finds its way into many of your stories. Casino is probably the most obvious example. If you don't mind sharing, what is it about addiction that compels you?
I do write a lot about addiction. I've had some personal experiences with it, but I also think it's something I'm drawn to because I'm drawn to the real challenges of caretaking. And I think the experience of addiction or the experience of caring for people who are going through addiction is just a really hard situation to be in. You want to take care of someone. You want to rescue them. You feel frustrated by them. There's a limit to what you can actually do for someone. So it's just an incredibly complicated and challenging aspect of life that more and more of us are dealing with all the time. So I think that's why I return to it so often in my work, is like thinking about what it means to try to take care of another person is endlessly interesting to me. And I think it's an important thing for us to write about and think about.
Mm-hmm. In several stories in We Want What We Want, you deal with a mother who has left and a father who has struggled to keep things together in the mother's absence. What is it about this dynamic that you decide to return to it in different stories?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I have a strong intent about it. I will say that I do write a lot about women and motherhood and parenthood in general. And I'm interested in trying to write about motherhood in ways that are complicated and three-dimensional. I think some of the cultural discourse around motherhood can be quite binary, like either people are perfect and angelic mothers or they are terrible and demonized. And I'm interested in all the kind of flawed and messy middle space between those two extremes. So when I write about women who find motherhood challenging, that's part of what I'm interested in doing, is sort of testifying to the complexities around, again, caretaking and families for women.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. In the acknowledgments to your book, you say that stories are your first and greatest love as a writer. Short stories are my first and greatest love as a reader. And I think that the main reason is, for me, that in a short story, a writer has the chance to take more creative risks because they don't have to hold the reader's attention for as long as they do over the course of a novel. I'm curious as to why the short story appeals to you.
I couldn't agree with you more about the short story as a place where writers can take risks. I think the short story is a real playground for experimentation. It's an incredibly elastic form. You can try things out in a short story that either in terms of the form or a challenging character or an approach to situation would just be really, really difficult to sustain. And then there's something about the experience of reading a story that has always spoken to my heart and mind in my own experience. So I think that reading a great short story is like hearing a song and then it lives on in your mind. It resonates. And there's something about the compression and brevity of it that makes it all the more resonant. When I first started reading short stories, people like Alice Munro, who's a great Canadian short story writer, the first time I read her work, I just felt like the back of my head was going to come off. I just felt both taken into someplace that was very new and unfamiliar, and I also felt deeply recognized and known myself, the way that she wrote so intimately about these characters' lives. I just absolutely fell in love with that experience, and when I write, I'm always writing back to that.
Do you have an all-time, this is a tough question, I know, but as you found out, Alex, I tend to ask tough questions. I said sarcastically, do you have a favorite Alice Munro all-time favorite Alice Munro short story?
Oh, it's hard to pick just one. I really love so many of her stories, but I'll never forget as a teenager reading her story, Wild Swans, which is about a young teenage girl who has a kind of unsavory experience on a train. And the way that it's written is so kind of morally neutral and emotionally authentic. And I thought, oh boy, this story is telling me something about the world that I really need to hear.
Mm. Alex Olin, thank you for joining us, and thank you for writing We Want What We Want. It's one of the best short story collections I've ever read.
Thanks so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Alex Olin is the author of the short story collection We Want What We Want. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Shay Serrano, Lori Wolliver, and Alex Olin. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Seems like a great idea all around.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Disagree with everything that he throws at you? Really takes the anger wind out of his brat sails.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
People who are amazing at their job don't have to point it out.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I mean, the man's just relentless and nice.